Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Tim Allis, whose new book is Henry Bendel and the Worlds He Fashioned. I'm so happy to welcome Lafayette native Tim Allis to The Reading Life. Tim was a senior editor at InStyle for 12 years, and before that, he was a staff writer at People and in Dallas at D Magazine. For his first book, Henry Bendel and the Worlds He Fashioned, Tim takes as his subject the tastemaker Henry Bendel. He chronicles Bendel's journey from Lafayette to New York and the beautiful jewel box of a store that endured in various incarnations for 123 years. It is part biography, part art book, pure pleasure. Tim Allis, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Now, Henry Bendel is a name you knew growing up in Lafayette, but you didn't exactly know the full dimensions of this man.
Right. I knew the name only because I grew up in a subdivision called Bendel Gardens in Lafayette, and that was adjacent to Bendel Road. And so it was just, Henry Bendel was just a name. And I can't pinpoint when it was that I actually understood that this was a man who had a famous women's clothing store in New York City. And when I did learn that, let's say maybe when I was in my 20s, it didn't have particular resonance. I started visiting New York in my late teens, early 20s. Bendel's only sold women's clothing. I never went into the 57th Street shop. And I don't know when it was that I realized, oh, our subdivision is named for that guy. Mm-hmm. And then figuring out what a big deal he was.
And there were challenges to undertaking this because he didn't leave a lot of written records, but you found wonderful things nevertheless.
It was challenging. I didn't know what sort of a record there was when I started digging. And, my impulse came about as kind of naive as thinking, well, there should be a book about this guy.
Yeah.
And when I realized how thin the record was, Over time, I came to realize, this is why no one's done a book about him. He's kind of hiding from us. And what I did find were a few academic papers that had been written about him, not particularly lengthy papers, and some family histories that had been passed down, and some monographs where different folks had taken clippings here and there. And that was the beginning of a pathway to trying to figure out who the heck he was.
So what was the connection you felt with him finally that would lead you to spend years on this project?
Well, I lightly researched Henry for a while, and then I did deeper research, and then I put it down for years. The final thrust of writing the book and doing some more deep digging was about a 2.5 year thing with another year for photo acquisition and editing and working on end notes and all the kind of fluff and fold. But I stuck with it because it kept nagging at me that there should be some light on Henry, that he's a lost figure who was just really quite famous in his day and then all but forgotten. And what was striking to me was that people in Lafayette knew little or nothing about who he was, even if many people in town knew the name and a few knew that he was the New York clothier. And then people in New York didn't know who he was. People in the fashion world didn't know. People who worked in fashion retail. Here's an anecdote for you. I met on the street one day the late film director Joel Schumacher. Mm-hmm. And I knew that he had started out his career as a window dresser at Bendel's in the early 60s. And I had a wonderful chat with him on the street, and he was very intrigued that I was pursuing this, but he knew absolutely nothing about Henry Bendel, the man. And so that made me kind of rewind the clock and realize that even as far back as the 1960s, people in the company didn't really know much about Henry himself, who died in 1936.
Now, the arc of his life is so astounding. He grew up in one of those complicated Southern Jewish families. He learned the dry goods business in the South before going to New York. I love it that there was an opera house above a dry goods store, too.
Yes. And you have to put opera house in quotation marks a little bit, because I think it could be anything. It was everything from family productions to traveling shows and Fado Do's or whatever went on up there. And it wasn't an elaborate, like we picture a formal opera house. It was a hall, a music hall, I think.
And he had quite an ecumenical background. He was Jewish, but he went to Catholic school, and he later became an Episcopalian.
Yes. He was raised in the Hebrew faith, and his parents sent him to St. Charles College in Grand Coteau, Louisiana, which is about half an hour outside of Lafayette. And that was really more of what we would think of as a high school or a transitional school. This was going to complete his education, even though he was leaving. He left there, graduated there at like age 16. But it was a Jesuit-run school. So however much he may have been exposed to, say, Catholicism, which is so dominant in South Louisiana, earlier than that, I don't know. But for sure, he was getting the Jesuit version at Grand Coteau. And first of all, it set a very high bar for his education. He was learning Latin, probably honing his French with something perhaps akin to Parisian French, and being exposed to the arts, but obviously history and literature. He also was invited to help the Jesuit priests with the vestments and decorating the altar for the high holidays and so on. So we think it was his first exposure to fine fabrics. He was always interested in fabric, and he helped kind of, I think, dress his sisters or fix up their hats if their hat wasn't right. He would sort of recast it and recraft it. But I think that time at St. Charles College as a teenager, 14, 15, 16, was extremely influential in his interest in fashion.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Tim Allis, whose new book is Henry Bendel and the Worlds He Fashioned. Now, he had a short early marriage that ended in tragedy when his wife Blanche died in childbirth. She was part of the Lemon family. And he lived most of his life with two male companions, John Blish, who worked at B. Altman's as a buyer, and Abraham Beekman Bastedo, a church organist. I love that he had pipe organs in all his houses. You know?
Yes.
And his great niece said, his companions were simply part of our family. So he had a large extended family and acceptance everywhere he turned.
He did. I mean, I think to a point. It's fascinating, the arc of his domestic life, his domestic arrangements. But it's very hard to know exactly what the character of each of those relationships were and what went on behind closed doors, big who knows. But the facts are that after working for a plantation store in Raceland, Louisiana, and then spending about a year or so in New Orleans, and we're not sure what all he did in New Orleans, but he may have done some shop work in New Orleans, and he certainly would have been exposed to all the great department stores like D.H. Holmes, which would have given him a taste of all that. he found himself in Morgan City, Louisiana, and that's where he really established himself as a businessman and started out in mercantilism, working for and then co-owning his own dry goods store. And while he was in Morgan City, a co-worker of his named Charles Lehman introduced him to his sister, Blanche Lehman, from New York City. Now, the Lehmans had come from New Orleans, and they were involved in the feather trade and other millinery-related trade. And Charles, I believe, had stayed behind in New Orleans and maybe spent some time in Morgan City. And the rest of the family was all up in New York City, making quite a go of it. And Blanche came down to Morgan City, and that's how they met. And we don't know how they courted. It could easily have been through letters. You know, things, courtships could happen very quickly. You know, marriage arrangement could happen very quickly. I don't know. Blanche was a divorcee who was coming off of a really horrible, abusive marriage, a husband who was very abusive. And she was getting on in age, as that goes back in that era. You know, she was in other words, she was in her late 20s,
right?
Right. And so you have to wonder, you know, I have wondered how much of their relationship was true love and how much was sort of just very helpful for both of them in their lives and their trajectories. But based on the record and what Henry left behind, I think he really was in love with Blanche. She did pass away within a year of their marriage. They were living in New York, and Henry did not decide to turn around and go back to Louisiana, where his family was, where he had a proven track record with mercantilism. He stayed in New York, and that's the distinction. And with regards to the men in his life, at some point in the few years after Blanche died, he first met Mr. Blish, and who became a lifelong companion, and then Mr. Bastedo later. And Mr. Bastedo was an Episcopal organist, possibly of some renown, and that may be how Henry came to make a conversion to the Episcopal Church from Judaism. We're not sure. But in any case, he did eventually live at times with both gentlemen, and both of them worked for the store, and they all traveled together. But I wouldn't say that it was open. I think it was hiding in plain sight. I think to family members, it was probably understood, but not even spoken about at the dinner table. And to the outside world, I don't think anyone would ever utter a peep about that.
And he was quite the patriarch of his Louisiana family. He approved the baby names, he designed wedding dresses and christening dresses, and he never forgot where he came from, or he never failed to take care of his family members.
Right, exactly. That's been one of the things that has really resonated with me, and I find so wonderful. In some ways, I don't think we should see it as surprising. And I think that maybe particularly, I think it's true of Catholic families, and I certainly know it's true of Jewish families. There is that extraordinary familial ties, those ties that last a lifetime. But from a practical standpoint, getting back down to Louisiana from New York in the 19-teens and 20s and 30s was not easy. He drove down in his Rolls Royce on many occasions. I think he must have also taken the train down or trains. But it was a big effort. And I know he, as much as he came down with relative frequency, at least once a year, maybe sometimes twice a year, I'm sure he never got to stay more than a few weeks at a time. And he probably would have loved to have been able to do that more. But yes, he was very doting on his family, on his many siblings, on his nieces and nephews. He did like to choose the baby names, sometimes French names. Like one of them was named Hélène, E-L-E-N-E. And he was generous with giving gifts to them, and I think sometimes money. And he also had some of them come up to New York and work for the store. So right. He very much kept the family close.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Tim Allis, whose new book is Henry Bendel and the Worlds He Fashioned. Now, he first gained fame in millinery because that was the era of the great feathered hat and the plume trade. And
right.
There's that wonderful line in Cole Porter's song, You're the Top, you're a Bendel bonnet. And that's a kind of immortality in itself, really.
Right, right.
And then we know it from Auntie Mame, Rosemary's Baby, Gossip Girl, Sex in the City. Bendel's just had a mystique.
It did. The hats alone, to your point, could have possibly cemented some sort of legacy for him, and certainly the Cole Porter lyric. But he quickly branched out to dresses and accessories and became a merchant more than a hat designer. You know, the hats put him on the map when he had a little hat shop on 9th Street, which originally I think was just to the trade, and then eventually was doing some retail business. And then he made a move and opened his first, but not his greatest, bigger clothing and hat store and accessories on 5th Avenue between 43rd and 44th Streets in 1906. But hats got him going, but he really came into his own in importing French fashion and then copying French fashion with permission from the couturiers to do that. And then in just running a great store. And mm-hmm. as you point out, it's a brand that far outlived Henry. It didn't go out of business until 2019.
And at one point, he was the leading importer of French fashion in the United States, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. There were other New York and other cities, too, merchants who were going over to Paris regularly and bringing French gowns. And they had very particular, very wealthy clients in the United States who some of those women would go on their own, of course, and pick their own outfits. But there were others bringing it over, but no one was doing it with the in quantity to the level that Henry was. And he was also early in the game, not the first and not the only, but the one who was doing it in the biggest way. And so many written records give him full credit for that. I didn't wonder if I was overstating that. Apparently he really was considered the great French dress importer at the time.
He also knew the value of celebrity dressing. Broadway stars like Billy Burke, of course, Tallulah Bankhead, Joan Bennett. So that was something he was early on to.
Yes, I have a big enthusiasm for the theater. That's my first love. Mm-hmm. So I think that more than anything is what really got me excited when I started digging into Henry's life. And he did a lot of stage dressing. He did not do many movies, just a handful. But with the stage dressing, I think it ran the gamut from he might actually sketch out, or one of his people might sketch out a costume for someone and then they would create it, to as maybe the producers came to Bendel's and pulled some Bendel outfits. But in any case, the Bendel gowns ended up on the stage. And he was so savvy about what a great marketing tool that was. It was back in that day, women particularly really did, part of why they went to the theater was to see the latest styles. And then there's this whole kind of, it's a synergy between the actresses wearing Bendel gowns on stage and then them wearing Bendel gowns in advertising and in editorial mm-hmm. and being seen out and about at restaurants. And so Bendel was really clever, I think. Henry was clever in recognizing the potency of actress celebrity, of stardom, in helping to grow his brand.
And his homes were another artistic outlet. There's a sort of Gatsby-esque grandeur to some of these residences, and you have lavish illustrations.
Yeah, he was such an aesthete, and I think that's a part of the story that's just key to his success. He mm-hmm. he didn't just love a beautiful dress. He loved really old, fine tapestries and European furniture and tile work and stone work and metal work. He had these elaborate iron gates at his first big mansion in Kings Point, Long Island, which really is Gatsby, that is Gatsby territory, and a house that he sold to Walter Chrysler. But he loved the history of it. He loved the detail. But more than anything, I think he just loved the aesthetic. So all of that is part of the secret sauce of Henry Bendel, that he was an aesthete, and he loved beauty in all its formats and or all its guises, including nature. I mean, he was just such a flower lover, a landscape enthusiast, and he brought that to bear in both the Camellia Lodge in Lafayette, which is the property that became Bendel Gardens, and then up in New York.
And he worked with naturalist Edward McIlhenny of Avery Island, which I thought was fascinating. It planted more than 3,000 azalea shrubs and 700 camellia trees. My goodness.
Yeah. My clever publisher, Josh Caffrey, through a research person at Avery Island, made the connection to McIlhenny. I hadn't found that, and it kind of late in the game, and it was so fascinating. And there are even some documents that Avery Island have that are some correspondence and long lists of camellia shrubs of every kind of name, all these varietals. McIlhenny was also a great naturist and botanist in his own right, and the two men bonded over that, and that helped inform the property. But it must have been beautiful. It would have been fairly rustic. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about the subdivision I grew up on,
right?
But different back then. It would have not, of course, had a lot of streets. I would have just had a couple of dirt paths here and there, but he planted camellias and azaleas and magnolia trees, and he formed an alley of magnolia trees from the entrance to the property, which is now one of the entrances to the subdivision at Bendel Road, where his house there, which wasn't very, very large, it wasn't small, but the Spanish-style mm-hmm. Camellia Lodge, he designed an alley that was going to lead to a much larger house that he intended to build, and unfortunately he passed away before he could do it. But that's now Marguerite Boulevard, and you can still drive along or walk along through this alley of magnolia trees that Henry himself had orchestrated.
Now, what did you learn from him in writing this book that was useful for your own life? What question would you ask him if you could?
I guess Henry inspires me to look for beauty in everything and to dream big.
Well, you really captured the essence of Bendel in the beautiful design of this book with the stripes that were so characteristic of the store. Florine Stadtheimer's wonderful Sunday sale at Bendel's. It's a lovely book. You can't resist it.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Tim Alice, whose beautiful new book is Henry Bendel and the Worlds He Fashioned. You can meet Tim October 9th at 6 at Cavalier House Books in Lafayette, at the Louisiana Book Festival in Baton Rouge November 2nd, and he'll also be at Octavia Books Sunday, November 24th. Tim, thank you so much. This book is such a pleasure.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
You the tops, you the Coliseum, you the top, you a Louisium, you a melody from a symphony by Strauss, you a Bendel bonnet, Shakespeare sonnet, you a Mickey Mouse.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Writer Alexandra Navarre Davis and illustrator Shannon Kelly Atwater sign Clyde the Giant Crawfish, Saturday, October 4th at 11 at Garden District Bookshop. Sonia Purnell discusses in Signs Kingmaker Pamela Harriman's astonishing life of power, seduction, and intrigue. Sunday, October 6th at 4 at Garden District Bookshop. Bakari Sellers discusses in Signs The Moment, thoughts on the race reckoning that wasn't and how we can all move forward now. Monday, October 7th at 6 at Baldwin & Company. Tim Alice discusses in Signs Henry Bendel and the Worlds He Fashioned, Wednesday, October 9th at 6 at Cavalier House Books in Lafayette. Joshua Perry discusses in Signs Seraphim, Wednesday, October 9th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Diane McPhail signs Follow the Stars Home, Friday, October 11th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. And coming up this month, the Friends of the Jefferson Public Library hold their big book sale Friday through Sunday, October 25th through 27th at the Pontchartrain Center, Williams Boulevard at the Lake in Kenner. Hours are Friday and Saturday, October 25th and 26th, from 10 to 7, and Sunday the 27th from noon to 5. This is one of the largest book sales in the New Orleans area, with more than 65,000 items for sale, including gently used books, puzzles, DVDs, CDs, and records. Cash and credit or debit cards only. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.